Earners, what's up? Look, in the world of personal finance management, finding the right tool is crucial. If you've been relying on Mint to keep your personal finances in check, I got a mix of news for you. Mint is closing down. But here's a silver lining. Monarch Money is stepping up as the go-to financial app, and users, including myself, are making the switch with a smile. Before Monarch, juggling my finances felt like navigating a stormy sea. Other apps either lacked features or were too cumbersome. Then came Monarch Money. Its ease of use, powerful features, and sleek design turned financial management from a chore into a breeze. The constant updates, well, that's the cherry on top. But what truly set it apart for me was its collaboration feature. Money matters can strain relationships, but Monarch brings peace to the table. The app's collaboration tools allow my partner and I to seamlessly manage our finances together. We aligned on our budgets, tracked our cash flow, and even planned our future goals all in one place. Speaking of goals, be it saving for a down payment, your dream vacation, or your children's education, Monarch simplifies it all. It's no wonder the Wall Street Journal hailed it as the best budgeting app. This isn't just an app. It's the next generation of personal finance management, ad-free, intuitive, and always evolving with you in mind. Now look, Monarch isn't just another app. It's the all-in-one solution, from effortlessly importing your data from Mint to customizing your dashboard to your heart's content. Monarch respects your privacy with a strict no ads, no data selling policy. This is financial management as it should be, focused on you. Look, after trying out Monarch for myself, I understand why it's the top-rated personal finance app. And right now, get an extended 30-day free trial when you go to monarchmoney.com/Mondays. That's monarchmoney.com/Mondays for your extended 30-day free trial.
We are looking at how do we make access to doing an investing in, say, an affirmation tower accessible to a larger group of people. And we're working on doing that now. We're considering a platform that's somewhat like crowdfunding, but a bit more liquid. But I think I think there are some ways now, like, for example, we are looking at investing in some REITs. So SL Green, which is just built one Vanderbilt office building right at Grand Central Station, the most successful office building in the marketplace. Their stock is down, 75-80%. And Vornado, which owns Farley Station, which is the historic building across the street from where we are now on 8th Avenue, and they own all these office buildings above Penn Station and Madison Square Garden.
Yes.
Their stock is down 70% or so. And so that's another place to play as well, because the market has penalized them heavily. And that's another way to invest in larger scale real estate. But overall, it hasn't been accessible. And so people have to become entrepreneurs themselves to do that. And that's a bit harder. But I would say that the way you start in the development business is do a house or two. Buy an apartment building renovate the apartment building and re-lease it up. Or buy a condo in a market that's emerging and it's an old building, and renovate the apartment and resell it. That's the way to get started, and then you start scaling it up. But the thing about real estate, though, is if you're going to get into development, you got to think big, and you got to be willing to scale up quickly. So think about this. The first building we developed was in 1989. I started on that in 86. That was $10 million. Affirmation Tower is $3.6 billion. So We got to scale up.
Troy. I see you got a question.
No, man. I mean, as you're talking, Donna, I'm just thinking to myself, as you look at the landscape, and we always talk about building generational wealth, and we know one of those ways to build it is through real estate. As you look out at the landscape from your position, looking at the new developers, people, the agents, the realtors, how encouraged are you when you see us in this space now? Because I would imagine 40 years ago when you were starting, it didn't look like us. And I was looking at the statistic, actually. It said in the second quarter of 2022, the home ownership rate of white households was 75%, compared to 45% of black households, 48% of Hispanic households, and 57% of non-Hispanic households of any other race. And so, are you feeling encouraged? Like, what is your thought from the landscape from where you're sitting at?
I mean, look, I'm encouraged by what you all are doing. I mean, I think you all are the bright spot real estate
Thank
and
you.
Entrepreneurship
Thank
for black Americans. What happened is during the 1960s, we all were fighting, my parents and my grandparents and all of our parents and grandparents were fighting for civil rights, basic civil rights, access to universities, access to, you know, accommodations, and access to educational institutions. And then in the 1970s, we got it. And so what happened is that prior to that, the best and brightest of us were entrepreneurs in many instances because we couldn't get jobs. No one would hire us. So we would create businesses and serve our communities in those businesses. What happened is, and then those of us who went to college went to historically black colleges by and large. So what happened is in the 70s and 80s, that changed. So we didn't become as entrepreneurial. We began to get jobs and better paying jobs. And that was the goal. And so what we see, that real estate's an entrepreneurial business, and it's severely underrepresented when it comes to black Americans. Home ownership rates for black households is lower today than it was in 1968 when Dr. King was assassinated. So, and in fact, in Boston, the average household net worth of a white household is $250,000, and the average household net worth of a black household is $8. Mm. And so what that is that we haven't been entrepreneurs. So there is a tremendous opportunity, though, for real estate entrepreneurship. The thing about real estate, and everybody ought to appreciate this, when you go out to raise, if I've got an app, if I've got some technology, et cetera, it's not a hard asset. So I got to go and find friends and families to help get me started and then convince people to put money into it. Yeah. In real estate, there's a hard asset that can be valued. So you are going to be 70% already on the way because you can borrow 70% in debt. And so it's easier to get started as a real estate asset owner because you have this hard asset. And then once that asset is appreciating, at the same time, if you own a rental building or a rental house, you're collecting rent, it's paying down your mortgage, paying down your debt, and the property is appreciating over time. And so you're getting an equity buildup that is pretty quick. And you'll ultimately be able to borrow against that too. So where I think there's no better time for us to be in real estate, it is the number one business in this country overall.
Let me ask you this. So is there anything that you think specifically would be smart to invest in into 2023 and vice versa? Are there things that you would not recommend to invest in going into 2023?
I mean, I think that I'd be cautious about financials. Like if I were going to be investing in the stock market, I'd be cautious about financials right now.
Don't tell me that. Oh, give us some gems, please.
I'd be looking. But I'd be cautious. I would clearly be looking at airlines, but cautious. But they're still under capacity. I'd be looking real hard now at the hotel market.
Really?
A lot of people are traveling. Hotel room rates are up, I mean, stratospherically. And so I'd be looking there. I tend to invest pretty much in what I know. I've done well. I mean, I bought Tesla early and well, and it's written it up and, you know, constantly up and but a little bit pullback here and there. But I think, you know, I mean, technology to some degree. But I also be looking at right now, the fact is that there is a untapped market in terms of providing capital to black businesses.
Absolutely. Please talk more about that.
And if you think about this, I got the Business Icon Award. It was aired last night from the GRIO.
Congrats.
That's amazing.
Yes, yes.
We were part of that presentation.
You know, there was two gentlemen who were part of the tribute video to you.
Yes. Troy and Rashad from Earn You Leisure.
You might know them.
They look good. Yes,
and I brought up in my acceptance last night that there is $83 trillion invested in venture capital and private equity right now. And less than 1.3% of that money goes to women and people of color combined.
You said 83 trillion?
83 trillion and 1.3%. So that means, so think about this for example.
And women and people of color. So that's Mexicans, that's Indian,
everybody.
That's every single person.
That's everybody. That's the vast
majority. The whole world.
So we're getting a quarter of 1%?
Right. So 90, So think about this, 98.7% of all venture capital money and private equity goes to white men. So the vast majority of the country is fighting to try to get access to start a business, build a business, expand a business, and they're fighting over 1.3%. And so our answer, and so when, you know, it used to puzzle me when I was starting my company and so forth, why I didn't see greater, you know, more black people. And I always wonder, well, why is it? Is it something we don't know? Well, yeah, something we don't know, it is that we don't get fair access to money, fair access to capital. So it's like, I mean, capital is the fuel that drives entrepreneurship and business.
Say that one more time. That's a great quote.
Capital is the fuel that drives entrepreneurship and business. It'd be like me saying we're going to drive from here to East Orange, New Jersey, but we don't have but a 10 cents of gas.
East Orange, make some noise.
Okay. And so it's unreasonable and impossible to expect me to get from here to East Orange with 10 cents of gas. Well, it's unreasonable to expect any of us to grow our businesses or start one without any money. And until our financial system is made fair, we're going to see these inequities. And so I think there's a tremendous business opportunity. I tell these heads of banks and so forth, you don't have to go to Southeast Asia or Eastern Europe to look for an emerging market. You got one right here. Black people.
Yeah.
Start treating us fairly. Start providing capital to us.
So how do we crack this code to raise more capital? Is it a strategy or insight that you see, or do we need to like grab Peter and have him do all of our deals?
What we need to do is what you said earlier. We have to work together. You close the wealth gap, like you said, by working together. So it's pooling our resources and working together. Not seeing each other as competitors, but allies.
Yeah, say that again. Shout out to Ally, too. Right. Can you say that again?
Shout out to Ally. Right, you can't. We cannot look at each other. I do not look at another black business person as a competitor.
Yes.
I see him as an ally and a colleague and somebody I'm rooting for.
My graduates from my school being Forbes,
bag drop.
A mic drop. Bag drop.
Bag drop.